Recording?
Yeah, recording.
This is Mom's Basement Podcast, episode 37, Game Chef edition.
Yeah.
So, you guys sick of reading Game Chef games yet?
Oh.
Honestly, I was sick of, the first 10 seconds I started.
Oh. Poor Game Chef.
Game Chef fatigue set in early?
Well, yeah, it's just because, you know, of my poor nutrition. That's all it is. It was too much of a hassle, too much of an endurance check.
Man, you should definitely consider opening your, opening the shades on your window there. Maybe getting a little bit of vitamin D.
Ew, shades.
My window is already open, as it is.
Oh, well, then maybe you should close it. Are you next?
You're breathing in the smog of...
to, like, a medical waste disposal center or something? Are you breathing in fumes?
It looks like just, like, another house across a fence, but, you know, you are right. It could be anything across that fence. I haven't been over there.
Man, and you don't know what they're burning.
Yeah.
Their basement.
Could be burning anyway, bodies.
Could be. Since we may have a larger audience for this podcast, although we may not, we may have just lost them right there. They may have turned their computers off or their closed the window at burning bodies, but we should probably introduce ourselves. I'm Will, also sometimes Hank. I don't give a shit.
I'm Rudy.
And yep. I am Alex.
And this is the least professional podcast on internets.
On internets.
Okay.
Yeah, we try to uphold the promise, but some people can be more unprofessional than us. But we try to get back.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It would be pretty hard to be more unprofessional than us. We suck pretty bad.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you how that happens when people don't record. That's more unprofessional.
So. Oh.
One of these days, we gotta pretend to not, you know. Actually, no, that's already happened before. A few weeks ago.
Well, and we've gone months without recording an episode. Remember our 6-month hiatus?
Well, yeah, that's because you guys were trying to strive to come back to number one as the most unprofessional.
That's true. Yeah. We had to work hard for that.
We did.
All right, yes, move on.
Okay. Anyway, so we're talking about Game Chef this week. Now, our one or two listeners may remember that months and months ago, I guess a year ago now, we did a series of podcasts on the Ronnie Awards where we would do our top 5 entries. We did it for the January Ronnies, February Ronnies, and the April Ronnies. We looked at all the Ronnie games. Each of us picked 5 of them that we really loved, and we talked about them. Of course, on average, there were only about between 15 and 20 Ronnie games each round, not 97.
Yeah.
So this was a little bit more daunting than we were expecting. But since there were 97 games for Game Chef, we've decided to up it to a top 10 for each of us. So we're each going to have 10 games. We've made a list. We've made a numbered list. We're going to talk about those 10 games in descending order, 10 to 1. And we also each have an honorable mention.
Yep.
Anything anyone wants to talk about before we get started?
Well, just so everybody knows, the Game Chef thing this year was what?
It was Last Chance Game Chef.
Oh, okay.
Because this is the last chance for Game Chef to talk about Game Chef. Game Chef, excuse me, on the Forge.
Yep.
Since the Forge is closing down.
It's going down.
And also because of all of the Mayan apocalypse nonsense. 2012 is the end of the world, so this is your last fucking chance.
Yeah.
Contrary to what some people have said, this is not the last Game Chef. Game Chef is coming back in 2013. It just won't be tied to the Forge anymore, since there won't be a Forge anymore.
Yeah.
And the 4 terms were?
I got them pulled up. Coyote, Doctor, Lantern, and Mimic.
Coyote, Doctor, Lantern, and Mimic. And that was Rudy showing why we're the least professional podcast on the internet. With plenty of static. And And maybe after we've gone through all the entries, we'll talk about how we felt about the terms and the entries in general and stuff.
Yep.
But what we really want to do is highlight the games we thought were interesting. Because a lot of times these contests come and they go, and games get forgotten. You know, how many Ronnie entries have made it from, you know, when they were submitted to being a full published game?
Yeah.
5 or 6 out of 50 over the years?
Yeah.
And how many Game Chef games? I mean, it's more common with Game Chef, but still, if they get, you know, in the ballpark of 100 entries a year, and out of those 100 games, 3 of them become published games, it's kind of a tragedy. So we really wanted to highlight some of the games that, you know, you may not see as published games down the road, that may never get the publicity that some previous Game Chef winners have gotten.
Right, right.
So, yep, this is our opportunity to do that. So, first off, honorable mentions. These are games that we really wanted to talk about, but for some reason or another, they didn't make our list. So maybe there was something really cool about the game, but maybe there was also something that was kind of lacking, or maybe we just loved 10 games and wanted to squeeze an 11th one in.
Yeah.
So, Rudy, why don't you get us started?
Okay, for honorable mentions, I'm going to have to make sure I pronounce this the right way here. So hold on, let me open the page up. Ultramondo Aceti La Svidia, or Svidia? It's called Ultra World. Will you rise to the challenge?
Ultra. Yes.
Yep, and if any of you Italians listening, sorry, I probably butchered that, but... Yeah, so this game was a game about a dude playing an MMORPG that was closing down. And he has to beat the last boss. And, I mean, just from that right there, I mean, that basically is awesome. I mean, I've never seen an RPG that's about that kind of situation, that kind of meta type deal where you're playing the guy who's playing the RPG. I just thought that was really cool. Now, mechanically, I don't know if I really understood it because I was opening it in Google Translate because I don't read Italian, but it seemed like the mechanics almost were reminiscent of like an MMO. Like an MMORPG.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, because like in the back they have all the mob names and stuff like that.
Yes.
And they have the boss's name. The boss is level 6 and the other ones are like lower level. And basically it's like one dude's quest to beat the boss, the big boss, which I thought was awesome.
Yeah, basically killing the sleeper.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Because it's a big, unique boss.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, he only can be killed, like, once or whatever. That was pretty cool.
Oh, that's an EverQuest reference.
Yep, the sleeper. Ooh.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I thought was really cool, though, he took it to an additional meta level. Because not only is one character playing the guy who's playing the game, but you're also... The other player is playing the character who is being played by the guy.
Yes.
Who's playing the game.
Yeah.
And you're playing a character that has transcended the AI and gained, like, self-awareness.
Yeah.
And if I got it right, is sort of trying to actively sabotage the attempts of the player to win the game, or to beat the boss and win the game.
Yeah.
The character doesn't want the game to end, because then the character ends.
Then he ends, yeah. Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool.
Some of the little details were awesome, too, though. Mm. Like, the guy is playing a pirated copy of the game that he bought off eBay.
Oh, was that what it was? I thought it was he bought the character off eBay or something.
Oh, maybe he's playing it. Either way, he illegally bought
it. It was illegal, yeah.
Right. And the person who previously had had that character had installed this script that's responsible for it gaining consciousness. You know, the way he works in, like, the standard sci-fi goofiness about, you know, the ways that AI regain, you know, artificial intelligence would become self-aware. The way he combines those tropes with, like, all of the little MMO details.
Yeah.
That someone who plays an MMO would know and pick up on right away. I thought that was really cool.
Yep. So that's my honorable mention. How about yours, Hank?
Mine? you know, my honorable mention could have been number one on my list. I wanted it to be number one on my list. I read the blurb, and I was like, yes!
Yeah.
Anyway, my honorable mention is Big Chiefs by Liam Burke.
Mm.
And it's a satire of the Dances with Wolves, Avatar, Last Samurai-style games, where an indigenous society is under attack, and, you know, by a group of basically white settlers, pioneers, or, you know, evil white dudes.
Right.
And then one of the evil white dudes, you know, goes native and somehow becomes better at everything that the indigenous people do and becomes their leader and all this ridiculous nonsense, you know, is basically the game of white co-option. And I thought, what an awesome satire.
Yeah.
You know, the potential is here for really awesome satire, especially given the crop of games that we're looking at.
Right.
And I think Liam Burke was aware of that, because on his thread on the forge, he says, you know, I felt like there was no game I could make that wouldn't be, you know, co-opting some other culture.
Mm.
And the sheer number of games here that are, you know, Native American games, where someone takes some element of Native American folklore or mythology and then grabs it and makes it into their game. So, you know, it was very timely.
Yeah, it was.
It was extremely timely. And on top of that, it doesn't just speak to game design, but it speaks to the experience of playing the game. Because this is, you know, as much as people are working to, increase the, add diversity to the audience for indie RPGs, this is still a very, very white hobby. And so, what are you doing when you pick up a game like Steal Away Jordan, for example,
right,
and you play it with a bunch of your white friends? is that an experience, you know, is that a positive, healthy experience, or is that co-option?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah,
or is it both?
Yeah.
And I think, so I really liked the idea of a game that was going to be a fun, satirical game that would speak to that. You know, what's going on within the RPGs, and also these ridiculous movies like Dances with Wolves, where, you know, you have the miraculous white guy who comes in and saves the natives.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, it's like almost the ultimate form of racism, where only the other race can be good enough to actually save the indigenous people.
Right.
Yeah, they're not, they can't save themselves.
And does everything better.
Right.
Yeah.
And he does everything better.
Right, and in some ways it's almost worse than, like, white power propaganda, because it's condescending on top of being derogatory, right? Because not only it's pretending to be, like, oh, this poor indigenous civilization is being destroyed, but it's like only the white man should save them. But anyway, with that in mind, and I read the first few pages, and I was getting into it, but my feeling is, and this is why the game is an honorable mention, mechanically, it never delivers on the promise to be that kind of satire. The mechanics of the game are really, they seem like they'd be very fun. It's kind of a, not exactly a Risk clone, but obviously they're based in the Risk board game. You know, you've got tokens, and you move them into a space, and the pioneers move their tokens into space, and then you have a, you know, you roll off, basically. And there's some traits you can apply and things like that. But nothing about the mechanics of the game really speak to the type of games, the type of movies that he's trying to satirize here. You know, when you get down to the basic mechanics, it could just as well be any war game. You know? And I mean, yeah, having the indigenous people be represented by little tokens, I mean, there's something there. But the thing is, the pioneers are represented by the same tokens, so it's not like... It's true that that kind of reduces everyone to being an extra, and there's that sort of sense of they've all been dehumanized.
Right.
But it didn't really deliver on the promise of being a satire as a game. When you're talking about the game here, the mechanics, it's a fairly generic war game. And I think what's really missing here is there's this whole, when he's talking about the setting scenes, when he's talking about, you know, the role-playing, the narrative part of the game, that's like one paragraph. And I feel like that's where the connective tissue really needed to be, between the character generation stuff, which hints at the possibility of a satire, and the theme description, which also hints at the possibility of this being a satire, and the meat of the game, which is totally disconnected from that. I feel if he works on that scene structure stuff, if he works on the role-playing instructional stuff, he can really build the connective tissue to make this work as a cohesive whole. But right now it's not there. And he also said that he made the game in like 24 hours, and you can kind of see that. But this is a game, of all the games on my list, this is a game I would most like to see really fleshed out into a big, you know, full game, into a big, full finished product. Because I think there's so much potential there.
Right.
Alex.
Alright, well, I really don't have any honorable mentions, and that's just because there was a lot of, under my elitist mindset, there was a lot of games that I really didn't care for to begin with, and so I really didn't even give them the credence of an honorable mention. I just have my top 10 by itself.
So Alex is going to be playing the cynic this time.
Okay, if that's what you want to say.
I could say the dickhead.
What was going on when I was looking at the lot of games? No, that's actually explaining what we feel about it. Let's just go on. Let's just start doing the top 10 stuff here.
Okay, okay. Sure.
That's cool.
We'll move on to the top 10.
Right, so I guess you can start off, Alex.
Yeah, that's what I felt like I was going to do, since I literally didn't have any honorable mention.
Yeah. Hey.
All right, so number 10, Tears in Rain. Now, what I was most interested about this was due to the fact that it was somebody that I semi-knew, and I've chatted with before, so, you know, I have a personal respect, sort of, with this game designer.
Who you podcasted with before. Who you cheated on us to podcast with.
Yeah.
Well, this was before you even asked.
Okay. That makes it fine, then. No, go on.
All right, so Will, next time you have a like a girlfriend or anytime you talk with your lady, make sure you talk about all the other ladies that you've had experience with, and then you bring them along, and you know let's have that conversation.
Point taken. So
at least I am VD clean. That's all that matters.
That's
true.
And no kids. I'm not pregnant at all.
Okay.
So, moving on. So, I know. Anyways, this one was a game by my doppelganger, the other Alex, Alex Mayo. And honestly, if you ever saw a picture of him, we look quite alike. He just has a greater tan than I do. But his game was called Tears in Rain, and it was a sci-fi scenario. where something, you know, it's like a spooky, you know, like a, what's it, is it called? Is it like sci-fi horror, or is it like a drama?
Space, like a madness.
Space madness, I think is what
they Yeah, he used, I know that was the reference, but that's just kind of like, you know, like Jungle Fever, you know. it's kind of retarded to say that alone. But yeah, basically something happens, you know, everyone freaks the hell out, and then, you know, somebody makes up a reason of how to solve it, and then they see if it works or not, and, you know, bad things will happen and it doesn't work. But what I liked about this one is that even though I don't really care for the style of play, the framework behind it made it to where it was very easy to understand, unlike a lot of the other games that were listed there. It was very easy to comprehend, and there really wasn't that much confusion in terms of, like, you know, adding up the solutions.
You mean, like, thematically it was very easy to understand?
No, like, what I mean by it, as in, you know, as everyone talks about, like, the greatest pet peeves of, like, games like Dungeons & Dragons, or what was that one game where you had to have, like, a scientific calculator in order to play?
Oh, that must have been.
There was another one where it was it's a very complicated game. But basically, there's quite a few games out there that are extremely popular. Like, you know, I'll just give, like, Traveler as an example. That one was very complicated.
Yeah.
Well, there's two different versions of Traveler. There's the simple and the complicated. Or, anyways, the whole point was the rule system got in the way of, you know, they slowed the game down. Because I believe we talked about that last week with mine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one of those things where I really appreciated that the rule system itself, while it was complicated in one sense, like as in, you know, making everything up, like all your traits and stuff, it was very simplistic in terms of getting the answer of whether you did it or not.
Right.
And, I mean, in one way, it heavily reminded me of the system that's already out there, you know, Lady Blackbird. But it was more of a, like, a full-on sci-fi, you know, like, aliens theme, instead of a, you know, Steamworks and, you know, trying to save a princess or some sort.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah,
that's pretty much what I like.
Do you have any thoughts on it, Rudy?
Well, I know it has, like, an Oracle system, like, what is it, Ghost Echo has a similar system. I know, I think that's kind of, I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah. I liked the way that he generated atmosphere at the beginning of this game, at the beginning of his little design document here, the way he pitches the game to us. I wasn't digging so much the, like you said, the very Lady Blackbird inspired mechanics. The mechanics felt a little phoned in to me, honestly, which is why I didn't make it on my list. But I definitely liked the way he sold the game to us. I was like, wow, this sounds cool. You know, this sounds like, you know, I would love to, I don't know, go out into space and go crazy if it's as fun as this game makes it sound.
Yeah, the blurb definitely had me, like, ready to jump for joy. Because I love space madness genre. In fact, there's a space madness game on my list. Another space madness game. But, yeah, I thought he did a really good job of setting up the atmosphere and that kind of stuff.
Okay. Rudy, you're number 10, huh? Oh, sorry, Alex.
No, I was going to say, that's pretty much all I have to say about it. You know, I won't sing, you know, a mountain of praise over it, because, like you said, Will, there's some parts where it was phoned in. It felt like it was. But other than that, I kind of like the idea, and plus, you know, it's a game of favoritism for me right now, just because it's somebody I know. So there was more influence on me giving a shit about the writing.
Okay.
Alrighty, well, my number 10 was Handle with Care by Jackson Tegu. This game...
Yes.
This game was just... This was just awesome, I thought. It's a LARP with the premise that your giant voyeuristic monster is looking in on the lives of ordinary people. And the way it works is you set up cardboard boxes. Like, you actually set up cardboard boxes, like real boxes. And then you, like, to use as the city. and then you walk around, and then there's another player that has a light or something, and he's trying to shine the light on the monsters and, like, expose them.
It's a flashlight taped inside a macaroni box.
Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, that's important because I think there's a rule that says that if you can hear the macaroni, like, you're supposed to pour the macaroni back in after before you tape it up, and if you can hear the macaroni, like, moving around, then you have to stop or something.
Well, you're moving the box too fast.
Yeah, you're moving too fast, right.
Because the box is the light truck that's supposed to catch the monster.
Yeah.
And the monsters are, of course, the players standing around the table. So if you move the box... So if you're playing the light truck and you just grabbed the box and jerked it around, you could get to anyone
really
fast. So you have to keep it moving at a slow, steady pace.
Right. But the main reason this is on my list is basically because I think somebody walking in on people playing this game would be fucking hilarious. Imagine walking in on, like, four adults that are playing, you know, this game. And they've got boxes set up in their living room. And one of them shining a light around. I just thought that was awesome. And I thought the atmosphere really reminds me of, like, I guess being a kid, maybe, or
yes,
very, I mean, it's really, the way it's written also is kind of, it's sort of written almost like it's aimed at children, but not, you know? And, I just thought the general atmosphere, and I think that's what he was going for, and I thought that he did that really well. That, this game really, really definitely has a certain atmosphere to it.
Capturing your childhood game.
Right.
Not the only one in this. Chris Edwards' game, the Simurgh.
Oh, yeah.
Same theme. That was one of the games that almost made it onto my list, but I just didn't have room for. And it's interesting, considering that the theme of Game Chef is Last Chance.
Mm.
And there were so many forward-looking games, post-apocalyptic games, that it's really interesting to also see several games that are looking backwards, you know, looking at childhood. Like, this is your last chance to re-experience childhood.
Right.
And there's To Travel These Pathways, which I'll be talking about later, also had that kind of childhood make-believe kind of feel to it. And I think that's kick-ass.
Yeah.
And it strips away the fucking pretense. And I think that's my favorite thing about Handle With Care. Like you're saying, imagine someone walking in on this.
Yeah.
On people playing this. Imagine how totally stripped of pretense their play is. You know, how fully playing this game, forces you to revert to the kind of childhood make-believe behaviors that are really, I think, at the heart of the reason why a lot of people play RPGs.
Yeah.
And the old D&D Player's Handbook used to tell you as much. You know, it used to say, this is kind of like playing make-believe as a kid. So to have a game that says, nah, we're going to throw out all the pretense, all the nonsense, set up cardboard boxes on your kitchen table, get your old action figures out and play with them.
Yeah.
And pretend to be big monsters. It was like, yes.
Yeah.
The only thing missing was pretending that the floor was lava.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's pretty much all.
Yeah, I actually did do that, and you know what? I screwed up, and I would consider that an honorable mention myself, just because it was such a what the fuck.
Yeah.
You couldn't help but love it.
Yeah, you really couldn't. But yeah, so your number 10, Hank?
My number 10 is Young Turks at the Cafe by Zach Donovan, or Zachary Donovan. So, Alex is laughing at this game already, but I'll be honest with you. Any game that promises you that its mechanics can be used to play both both communists during the Russian Revolution and Jesus Christ and his disciples pretty much has me at hello. But this, I did though, and then what this game is it's a game not exactly about revolutionaries. It's basically about privileged middle-class kids, whatever the middle class of their society is, getting together and talking about social problems. And that could lead them to become revolutionaries, or it could lead them to basically become cowards. Mm.
So basically armchair revolutionaries.
Right, exactly. It's the that's exactly what it is. It's the armchair revolutionary game. It's about a group of, and they're not just kids, there's a professor or a doctor with them, too. Mm. But, you know, it's a group of people in a fairly comfortable position. I mean, they're getting together at the cafe or the equivalent, you know. It's people who don't need to be revolutionaries.
Right.
It's people who don't, who aren't, you know, whose revolutionary feelings aren't, you know, created by necessity. They don't come from poverty or desperation. These are people who may be sincere, but they're also in such a lucky, privileged position that sincerity maybe will only take them so far. So I thought the pitch of the game was really cool. You don't see many games like this. But what really sold me on it were the mechanics. Because the mechanics are able to find a really cool middle ground between being a discussion group and being a game.
Yeah.
And being a conversational exercise and being an RPG.
Right.
And I really dug that about the game. I'm not going to go super deep into the mechanics because I realize we don't have a lot of time here. One thing that kept it from being higher on the list was I felt like the endgame mechanics, which basically involve rolling dice and generating a kind of outcome for your characters, were too disconnected from what's going on during the discussion scenes.
Mm.
With the fruitful void. I know that feeds into the end a little bit, the stuff that you added to the fruitful void, which are kind of the topics for continued conversation, do feed into the end. But I feel like there's a certain arbitrariness about how the game ends, and I would have liked to see a tighter mechanical linkage between what's going on at the heart of the game and how it ultimately turns out. Maybe some mechanics for deciding whether or not you really become a traitor or whether you follow through on what you're going to, you know, on your revolutionary ideas.
Hmm.
And what was there in the game wasn't, a lot of it was just, oh, you know, make a decision. Which
right.
is cool, and which works in some games, but between the, oh, sort of make a decision on your own part of the mechanics, and the roll the dice once to see how everything turns out, it feels like it feels like the work and energy that you would have put into the body of the game doesn't really pay off at the end of the game.
Hmm.
But I really dug the structured discussion as a game idea, and I really dug the idea of a game about revolutionaries that isn't about revolutionary violence.
Hmm.
You know, it's sort of proto-revolutionary. Revolutionaries, a game about the revolutionaries before they become violent revolutionaries, I thought was a cool idea.
Yeah.
I want to talk about that one for a little bit, just because like it's only like two or three things I want to say about it. I also have it on my list as well, so I can just skip mine when I get to that. But I really liked it because, number one, I think it's a reference to a type of people. Because when you see young Turks at the cafe, what it reminded me of was, I don't know if anybody remembers this, but when Air America was still around, there was three people. They were called the Young Turks.
Oh, right.
For their broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what it was is they referenced themselves. Their explanation was that they were, you know, they were Turkish, they were Turkish descent.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they went to the U.S. when they were little. And they talk about all, like, these freedoms and stuff like that, so I think it's almost like a meta game referencing, because, like, if you see the dice pool, it's red, white, and blue.
Yes.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's either French colors or American colors. So it could be American people who were of, like, young Turkish descent talking about how to fix the Turkish country when they're doing nothing in reality to actually help it.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely the potential for this to be a satirical game. And that's what I was expecting when I first grabbed it. I was like, oh, this is going to be, you know, a satire about, like Rudy said, armchair revolutionaries. And I like the fact that it can be played as that, or it can be played straight face. You know, it can be played as a straight-up game about these individuals and their struggles, or it could be played as a satire of do-nothing revolutionaries.
Yeah, see, that's exactly what I was going to say about it. But yeah, I mean, when I read it almost as satire, but the fact that it can be played both ways is pretty, you know, it can be played as a serious debate, too, or a satire, is pretty cool, I thought.
Okay. Any other thoughts on Young Turks?
Nope.
Nah. Has everyone said their number 10 game, or does Rudy still need to say his?
Nope, I said mine.
Yeah, he said his.
Well, I have most least professional podcast on internet. Okay, Alex, you're number 9.
Alright, so my number 9 is a game called Into the Void, which is almost exactly like Tears of Rain in terms of the space madness thing.
Space madness.
But it definitely... And in general, I really don't care for you know those styles of games just because I can't pretend to act manic when I do my role playing there. But I really liked it because if you ever like you know, play like Call of Cthulhu or any of these type of games where you're designed to fail,
right?
This is almost a perfect adaptation of that kind of style, but without having to put so many. So much extra garbage in the way.
Right.
Because, like, if you played Call of Cthulhu before, you would know that everything's, like, based on a D100 system, unless they changed it. I just remember playing from 5th and 6th edition. Everything's based on a D100, and there's a whole huge list of irrelevant stuff that you need to have skill points put into. But this uses more of a trait system, like, you know, like what I was talking about with Tears and Rain. The only difference is you have a you're designed to lose these traits because the dice system makes it to where you're more likely to lose stuff, and there's a bit of back and forth in terms of the drama aspect of the system itself. So it can get as hectic as a normal Call of Cthulhu game where you know your characters are going insane, but it doesn't have to. You don't have to worry about rolling a crap ton of dice or doing a whole bunch of micromanaging.
Right, yeah, and this game is also on my list, so basically what I was, I mean, the same thing, Alex, I like the trait system because it's a unique take on traits, kind of, because you have it splits them between the inner line traits, which are like how your character sees themselves, and the outer line, which are how other people perceive them, and I think that's really important for this, you know, genre, you know, of game, like Space Madness. It's important that there be something there that lets you kind of mechanically express how the crew sees the other crew members there. And I thought it just did that perfectly with the trait system.
Because a lot of the things that go wrong with almost all those kind of paranoia games is, in reality, a lack of communication.
Right.
You know, kind of like with, like, The Walking Dead and all that kind of stuff. Almost all the problems will be solved if they actually talk to each other.
Right.
But they don't, and that's what builds the drama.
Right.
By, you know, people going crazy and all that kind of crap.
Yeah.
So, having an inward and an outward appearance makes a lot of sense because that's exactly what goes wrong in all those situations.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I like the fact that she encourages you to actually record your to make inline traits. Okay, you basically do a journal on like like a video journal type entry if anybody's ever seen like Avatar, like Jake talking to the camera, that type of deal. But she actually encourages people to record their video entries and put them on YouTube, which I think would be awesome.
Yes.
I like
that. Rudy, you said she. What's the author's name again?
Kira Scott.
Okay, I don't think it was mentioned.
Right.
I just wanted to make sure everyone gets...
Gets
their name mentioned, so that if someone's trying to track down these games or the authors, they can do so.
But yeah, I also like the way the stages build kind of tension. And this is something that I've tried personally to do in a lot of games that that I've never really thought really I pulled it off. But I think this one pulls it off because the way the traits interact with the void, you know, like where you can lose traits to the void and then you can get them back, but it's difficult. I think that kind of, it just kind of wraps everything together nicely so that play flows smoothly, I think. It seems like this game would be really easy to play, like to just sit down and play.
Cool. I did not have too much to say about this game. Besides what you've already said, Rudy, I really like the way that you have the inner traits and the outer traits, because like you said, perception is really fundamental in that genre.
Hmm.
You know, because you always think you're sane.
Right.
Everyone around you says, well, you know, he's gone off the deep end, he's gone batty. And the audience watching in the theater says, he's out of his mind.
Right.
He not see he's out of his mind.
Right.
This game didn't make it on my list, and mostly for the personal reason that by the time I got to it, I was suffering from trait fatigue. I must have read the word traits, like, over 1,000 times while I was reading through these games. And I was like, oh my god, another fucking game that uses traits. And they all use, and so many of them use traits in such a similar way that it was starting to seem like a crutch. And I was like, fuck these trait games. But no, I think that, all in all, I don't remember it too clearly, but from what you've been saying, and from what I do remember, it sounds like it was a pretty cool game.
Sweet.
Yeah, I just like the idea, like, I don't remember it, but based on the pitch you're selling me now, it sounds fantastic.
Sounds awesome.
My number one. All right, Rudy.
Right, so my number nine was the Coyote Load. And this is a game that's basically an OSR dungeon crawl, like old school Renaissance dungeon crawl type deal. But the catch of it is, and this is what made it make my list, is that it involves people looting a mine after a mining disaster. Now, granted, it's a supernatural mining disaster. Basically, all the miners were turned into zombies or something like that because they dug too deep and they dug into hell. And then hell comes up and turns them into zombies. But just the fact... Kind of like Doom, I guess, but anyway.
Yeah, I thought of Doom.
Yeah, but just the idea that it's a game set in the Old West. It's a dungeon crawl set somewhere else, you know, besides the standard D&D, what you'd expect type of dungeon. And, I really like the premise a lot. partially because it's kind of reminiscent of maybe real life events. Like, I mean, there have been real mining disasters in the news, like, over the past few years. So, but, and I think that kind of ties in nicely with everything. But the other thing I like about it is the system, because it's kind of a simple, it's old school, but it's really simple. And it seems like it's crunchy enough to provide replayability. But it's easy enough so that you can just pick it up and make characters and just go and just kind of get started with it. And I thought that was really cool because I think that's one thing that is really important about if you're going to do an old school game, it has to be accessible for people who want to play it over, you know, Dungeons & Dragons or something. You might say, well, why would you play this over Dungeons & Dragons? You'd say, well, you know, you can play this, you can generate characters really quickly, and you can be in the game, get started really quickly, and plus it's got a unique theme. So, I don't know, did you guys have anything?
Not too much. I mean, a unique theme that's also really cheesy. I mean, this is an OSR game through and through.
Right.
And that's what's cool about it, is while you're right that it, you know, embraces some modern sensibilities in terms of simple, easy-to-pick-up mechanics, in terms of content and the maps and all of the goofy shit that's in this game, it's an old-school goofball game through and through.
Right, and it never apologizes for being that, either.
Right. Right, and that was probably the most appealing thing. I'm not really an old-school pen-and-paper kind of dude. I guess I'm not to the point where I feel nostalgic about that, but for what it was, I thought it was a pretty good game.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty cool. And the other thing I thought was kind of neat is the way they have the different roles. Like, there's the leader, and then there's the mapper. And, like, the leader sets your initiative in battle, and the mapper is kind of there to draw the map as you go through the dungeon, which is something I think is really important if you're going to have a dungeon crawl, is that the map be kept somewhat secret from the players so that everything's a surprise. And just the idea of having somebody there to draw the map, and, you know, they're kind of playing around while you're playing the game. I thought that was really cool.
Well, man, Rudy, are you hating on my fuck it, drop the map on the table?
No, I mean, I do that, too. I mean, that. Yeah, I mean, I do that, too. But, I mean, I think for this type of old-school dealy, I think that was really what was being, because there's, like, there's a provision for, like, the mind flooding. Like, I think every 10 minutes real time, the mine, a section of the dungeon floods. So I just thought, I thought that was really cool because that then people are kind of scrambling to figure out how the hell they get out of there, you know, at the same time while maximizing their loots, which is pretty cool.
And you're right, the mystique of the map is important.
Right.
It's such a central part of what sold those games back in the day.
Right.
It's all about, like, creating a sense of urgency. That's why that every 10 minutes there's a flood. So that way you don't just sit on your laurels and just wait it out
right.
for somebody else to fix it. Everyone has to go bam, bam, bam right away.
Right.
And since there's no clear exit sign, you have to actually work twice as fast in order to just see what is in the next room.
Right.
You know, freak out if it's more zombies or, you know, be sad face when it's just another flooded area.
Yeah.
And having something to establish that sense of urgency is something that was seriously lacking from a lot of these old school games. Those very static seeming dungeons where it's like, well, I can go in this room whenever I want to because that gelatinous cube is not going anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
So let's go back to town and sell our shit and come back.
Yeah.
Okay. Are we done with the coyote?
Yeah, that's pretty much
load?
Yep.
Have we blown the coyote load?
We blew a big ropey coyote load in it.
I don't know. Probably. Okay.
Right.
One of these days, Will's going to be able to tell us about his number 9.
Yes.
One of these days.
Is Guilty, with an exclamation point, by, I apologize in advance, Mackenzie Giacomo. I tried.
Yeah. Okay. We're not native Italian speakers, so.
No.
We're doing the best we can.
But really, I was really digging a lot of the Italian games that were submitted, and probably my list would be really heavily weighted with them if Google Translate didn't make several of them totally incomprehensible.
Right.
But Guilty, what Guilty is it's a fun sort of social party game where you pretend you're, where you mimic putting on a trial, basically. There are four criminals who are being tried, I guess, for the same crime, basically, and they try to defend themselves by implicating each other. So I'm not the murderer, he's the murderer because.
Right.
While one player plays a neutral, while one player plays a dual role of being, like, the neutral adjudicator and also the prosecution.
Hmm.
But the thing that really sold me on this game is it uses newspapers to inspire the crime.
Right.
And also to inspire the defenses.
Oh.
So the prosecutor will pitch the game by picking up a newspaper and cutting out a headline or a blurb or a picture or something, and then using that picture to explain what the crime was. And he doesn't have to take it word for word. I mean, if the headline says, you know, drugs found in Malone, New York basement, it doesn't have to be about drugs, you know.
Right.
It could be, or if it was, let's say, black plastic bags filled with marijuana found in Malone, New York basement. It wouldn't have to, that wouldn't have to be the crime. You could say, he could take part of that and say, okay, they found a body chopped up in black plastic bags in Malone, New York basement. And you're being accused of the murder.
Yeah.
And then when a defendant wants to implicate someone else in order to get the heat off of them, they also have to take either a new paper or the same paper. This wasn't totally clear because of Google Translate.
Mm-hmm.
But they also have to take a paper and cut a blurb out of it and use that blurb in order to frame their defense.
Oh.
So, you know, they might say something like, if it was the same article, you know, there was also a chemical smell in the basement. And they might say, you know, well, it couldn't have been me, because I don't know how to, you know, because the cops found traces of bomb-making chemicals at the scene.
Right.
And I don't have the scientific knowledge necessary to produce these chemicals, so it must be the doctor.
Oh, yeah.
The character who is the, there's set roles, and one character is the doctor, and he's the guy who has the scientific knowledge. So I thought that was a really cool way to force people to think on their feet without making it be just a total, you know, debate team simulator.
Right.
I like that there's a physical component to this. You know, you can't just think up the best argument and pitch it. You have to use something to inspire your argument.
Right.
And I think that's where the uniqueness comes in. I just imagine this must be a really fucking fun game to play. I mean, I'm having fun just pretending to play it myself right now. I mean, it just seems like, doesn't that just seem like it'd be really cool? That kind of, like, because you get to pretend, you know, you get to play attorney, and you get to play, you know, law and order, basically.
Yeah.
But you also get to have a goofy, like, scrapbooking mechanic, and you have to think on your feet, and it's so simple, too.
Yeah.
The game, so simple, so straightforward, so intuitive, and yet, so, it seems so implicit. Fun. It just seems immediately fun to think about. My one minor problem, the one thing that kept this from being higher on the list, was the scorekeeping mechanic.
Hmm.
Basically, the winner or loser is determined, the player who's playing the prosecution / adjudicator, whenever someone makes a statement, they basically score whether they think that's an acceptable alibi. Or whether they think it's a, whether they think, nah, this dude's guilty. So you get guilty points or you get alibi points and you tally them up at the end of the game. And the person with the most guilty points is guilty. And I feel like, I don't know. I feel like that's kind of a cop-out mechanic, personally. And I know I used the word cop-out before, but it seems like... It doesn't seem like a very satisfying way to resolve the game, having one player sit there and basically just use their totally subjective judgments to tally up the score.
Right.
And I know that whatever you use for a game like this, it's going to be subjective. I'm not asking for a totally objective way to figure out whose argument is better.
Right.
But I felt like there needed to be something a little weightier than that, than just having one guy basically say, oh, I think he's guilty.
Yeah.
And that, so I feel like, and I don't have any suggestions, I just feel like if there was something that tied more directly, maybe if you gave points based on how many of the words in the article or snippet you were able to incorporate, or if you gave points based on how effectively you incorporated information from the article with the statements made previously by other defendants.
Oh, yeah.
And he hints at that. You should kind of subjectively judge that way in the document.
Mm.
But if there was something that, if the point system really had more bulk to it, if there was an easier way so that the person who's sitting there adjudicating had better guidelines for determining how they should be scoring points.
Mm.
But the actual play itself, scoring mechanic aside, sounds like it would be a hell of a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Did anyone else take a look at this game? I know you had the same trouble with the Google Doc.
I briefly looked at it, and yeah, it basically looks like a really fun pickup game for parties and stuff. I mean, just the fact that it's about, it kind of has that debate team feel, but it also has silly stuff like you get to cut out of a newspaper and stuff. And also, basically, what was I going to say? Oh, well, basically, I really like games that try to get at trials and that type of deal, because I've never really seen a game that does it right, and I think this game does.
Yeah, it gets at what's fun about it.
Right. Right, instead of the procedure and that kind of stuff, it gets really at the heart of the people.
Right.
But, I didn't fully read this, and that's just because, honestly, when I saw that there was an Italian section, I thought that was just, for some odd reason, they were just going to, like, retranslate everything into Italian.
Oh.
Or, Italian to English, so I never bothered looking at that section at all.
Right.
But just from what you guys have been, like, discussing there, it really sounds like it's more of an improvisation game. Kind of like a Whose Line Is It Anyways?
Yeah, there's some elements of that, definitely.
So just from hearing it, it didn't feel like it really was a game, like, in actuality. It was more like, it was like, that whole thing about, like, RPGs, like, what's an RPG, what's just, like, just you two guys, bullshitting each other. And that one, just from the description, it felt like it's, just guys bullshitting each other.
Right. Well, yeah, whether or not it's an RPG, I mean, it's definitely a game, because there's a scoring mechanic,
right.
And there's role-playing. I mean, there's assuming characters in order to, refute these claims that are being made against you, in order to defend yourself. I mean, in my opinion, it's a role-playing game, but I have a very, very loose opinion of what a RPG is.
Okay, like, have you played the Mom's Basement RPG?
The Mom's Basement RPG? Is that really what people just sit around and bullshit?
No. You play as three people. It could be anybody, but, you just play as three people, and you just go around talking about whatever topic you want, and then at the end of the game, you decide when it's over, and you just unplug the recording microphone.
Honestly, I would think that would be an RPG.
Anyways, yeah, I'm not gonna shit on this game, but just from here, like, I really do like the concept of that. It's just that I feel personally it's more of an improv technique than it is an actual game.
Mm. And you probably felt that about a lot of these games, then, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. There was a ton of the games where I felt like, where's the actual game to this game? It's more like just role-playing until you feel satisfied that you're done.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's good. We have Alex Swingle to provide contrast on that issue, then. Yep. Versus me, who's like, everything's a role-playing game, and it's all RPG. Whatever, man. Okay, are we ready to move on to number 8?
Yep.
Yeah.
Alex, what's your number 8?
Alright, so, I want to switch things up a bit, because I booked it at 7, but now I'm going to swap it to 8.
Ah.
So hold on to your horses then. This is controversial decisions.
Holding on.
Of Hollow Spaceman RPG. It's called Getting There in Time. By the great and powerful Dan Maruschak.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah.
Now, honestly, the main reason why I picked this is just because it's a Doctor Who reference. The entire game is based on Doctor Who. Mm. And the mechanics are almost flat out stealing Smallville. In terms of the D4, is it like D6, D10, like D12 or something like that? They go up in ranks for your skill rolls.
Mm. Oh, like a dice rank type system.
And like it's a dice rank system, and it's all about the personal drama of going around, you know, from place to place, being the doctor. I don't have much to say about it after that, but it was just one of those things where I wanted to mention it. And like I said before, I don't really have that many. I didn't really have that many honorable mentions because, you know, I had zero, and that was just something like my top 10 list. Honestly, like I have like 4 actual games that I cared about, like, and the rest are really honorable mentions.
Games you wanted to talk about?
Yes, and that's just one of them I wanted to talk about.
Nice.
So, did any of you guys read it? Because.
I know Rudy read it.
Yeah, I read it, and I thought...
Yeah, Rudy, you had to read it.
It's Dan Maruschak, so... But, I didn't really see the... I haven't really played Smallville, so I didn't really see the mechanics of stealing from that. But one thing I thought was kind of cool was the way you sort of generate your own rolling system or your own dice rolls, like what you have to roll against, like... Because they have... What were they called, Cruxes or something?
Cruxes.
Right, yeah, and basically you have to, like, you'll have something like, one crux will be like, I'm trying to think of a good way to explain it. Basically, it would be something like roll this versus that. So you might have roll, like, your anger versus your caution or something like that, just as an example of that. But, I thought that was kind of cool that he put in a way, kind of to decide how you roll. Just the way I don't know if that's what it really is, but just a way to, just that whole Cruxes system was really cool, I thought. And that it, yeah.
I don't have much to say about this game.
Yeah, other than that, I didn't really find much that I disliked or liked about it.
I don't know. I'm not a big Doctor Who fan. I've seen a few episodes, and I'm not a big fan of this particular type of crunchy dice mechanics that are in this game. Hmm. So I kind of tuned out early for personal reasons. Hmm. So it just wasn't a game for me.
It is a bit crunchy. I ain't gonna lie about that. But yeah, that's all I got. But I'm not really gonna defend it too much because, the main reason was that, I mean, you know, we heart Dan.
Yeah, we love him.
Much love.
And
Dan.
I wanted to highlight what Dan does. All right, so yeah, moving on.
right.
Dan
yep.
Rudy, what's your number 8?
All right, my number 8 is Walk Through the Forge by Dev. I think it's Dev Perkishaw. /For Great Justice Games. I think that's his his site there. Yeah. This is basically a war game. And it's a war game that lets you do something that I always do in war games anyway, which is narrate the shit that happens to your troops. I mean, in Risk, I mean, who hasn't done that for Risk? Or some other war game, you know, like Stratego or whatever, like, narrate, you know, like, this dude has a family, and, you know, he goes out, and, you know, he's traveling through Africa, and he gets blown away, and now his family's sad, and this and that. But, no, this is, one of the ingredients he used was narrativist war gaming, which I think is pretty interesting idea of itself. But, basically, the other thing I liked was the way that kind of the workload of the game is distributed into roles. Like, you have a facilitator, which is basically like the GM, but then you have other roles, like you have a cartographer whose job it is to draw the map and to, you know, move things or whatever on the map. And basically, it tells the cartographer that, the map is going to be altered in the, you know, it says, you know, don't be too kind of, don't get too attached to the map because it's going to be altered a lot. And, I just like the idea of somebody in charge of like a changing kind of morphic map during the game. But another role is the master of war, and it also has one called the Master of Sciences. I really like these because they let you kind of basically invent rules on the fly about how things will work. Like, which I think is something that happens a lot anyway in a lot of war games, you know. Like Risk, there's always, you know, some house rules and stuff that you have.
Right.
But the way these work is basically, like the example he gives here is, like, say you want to intimidate, say one of your soldiers wants to intimidate someone. The Master of Science could say, because that's his domain, you know, because he's kind of the arbiter of, like, probability, and it says outcome, but, yeah, but basically, like, let's say your soldier wanted to intimidate another soldier. The Master of Science might make up something on the fly that says, okay, if you roll 5+ on that, then he's going to be intimidated. But then if you needed rules for intimidating, say, a civilian, which is the example he gives here, he might say, well, you need 2+ on your dice roll. Uses D6s, I guess. But I just like that idea of having kind of a way in the manual to invent house rules for the game. I just thought that was really cool. The fact that it encourages you to do that kind of stuff that people do anyway. And I'm trying to think of any other things about this game. The one thing I did like also is basically, you can introduce new elements into the scenes at any time. You just have to spend a currency. And basically, like, you can, like, some of the things you can introduce new protagonists, and you can give them goals, and bring in new NPCs. And I thought that's pretty cool because, I don't know, who doesn't name their pieces for Risk, you know? Who doesn't give some of their pieces names and, like this guy is General Akbar or whatever. I mean, no, I just thought it was a really cool idea. The idea of narrating war game, or narrativist war game, as it's called. I just thought that was such a cool idea.
This really sounds like Rudy being so happy that someone has finally made the version of Risk that you've been playing.
No, exactly. No, that's exactly what it is. I'm just, like, in awe, basically.
Somebody gets me.
Yeah. No, I thought it was a really cool game.
Cool. Alex, did you have any thoughts on this game?
Yeah, I pretty much am in full agreement with Rudy there. Like, I the main thing I did like was the four main, profiles that as you can play as.
Right.
I really didn't like it that, you know, the guy just pretty much says if you want to have more than four players, just, you know, they're just random guys and just have to deal with it.
Yeah.
It was more like, you know, there's no reasoning behind the actual game. It's, you're going to do this, and if you don't want to do it, tough luck, you're going to do it.
So you would have liked maybe some rules for making up new rules on the fly, then?
Well, just for, like, other players beyond those four. Because they say that you could have more than four players, but there really is no purpose behind the other four players besides to help influence the other four.
Right.
So yeah, that's pretty much the only fault I really found with it.
I don't have much else to say about that game. What about you, Hank?
No, I mean, how are we doing on time, Rudy?
We're actually over an hour right now. We're 1:10.
Over an hour right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be a very long discussion if we keep.
It'll probably be a 2-hour podcast. Yeah.
This is going to be a monster podcast.
Yeah, it is.
What's going to happen is we're going to have to include an intermission where we all go out to go to the bathroom. Rudy can put some music on.
Bathroom break.
Yep.
Wow.
I ain't going to lie, I already did that, like, mid-discussion about the Warlords game.
I've been crossing my legs and shifting around in my chair here, so I might have to run in a minute, too. Have to keep our reputation as at least a professional podcast on internet somehow.
Now, you see, you guys aren't doing it right because I have a cup here that I'm going to piss in if I need to.
Really? Now, are you just bullshitting us, or do you actually have...
No, I actually have a cup here. I was drinking out of it earlier, but I didn't bring it in here specifically to be pissed in, but if I need to, that's where I'm going to go.
Well, I made the mistake of drinking a full 12 fluid ounce thing of Yoo-Hoo that I had planned to use over the course of the podcast, because my throat's going to get hard. In the
dude, enough piss talk. Come on.
Yeah, no, this is important. Yeah, this my game number 8. I really am going to duck out of here at one point to use the bathroom. But my and since this is Mom's Basement podcast, and we don't do any kind of editing. And we don't believe in pausing or ending something and editing the audio together to make it look seamless. You're just gonna hear me leave at some point. But anyway, my number 8 is Lies of Passage by Lucas Tor. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I know.
Zretzky?
Yeah, that was a tough one for me too.
Yeah. Now, I come from, it's a Polish last name, and I know I come from, I'm about quarter Polish, and I know that some of my grandparents' name or great-grandparents' names and relatives' names, I'm like, oh my god, how do you, but, Gertz Wetzi, what, I should have just quit while I was ahead, I'm stopping now. Lucas. Tor. Lies of Passage. This game is... It really gets at a theme that I think it has been running... Well, it gets at a couple of themes that have been running throughout this game, Chef. There were a lot of entries that really try to strip down RPGs to just one of their elements. Like, take RPGs and make an RPG that is just storytelling.
Right.
Or make an RPG that's just setting design, which is a game that I think is on a couple, at least two of our lists, but we'll get to that later. So, this game is just pure storytelling. This game is just pure setting design. This is just pure childish imagination play. You know? And I thought that was a really cool thing. And I kind of worry that maybe that in part came from people being in spot, like, ooh, Native American, that's back to nature. Let's try to bring RPGs back to their purest, like, the noble savage theory of RPGs. So that's a little worrisome, I guess. But I liked the game design decisions that resulted from that. Several of the games on my list are those games that took one part of the conglomeration things that we think of as RPGs and really just took it there, set it aside, purified it, and tried to create the best experience possible with just that little chunk. And Lies of Passage is the first example of this. This is a game that is RPGs as just pure storytelling. Mm. The hook here is that a group of young coyotes, as part of their rite of passage, have to go on an adventure and get fired. And when they went on that adventure, something happened, they fucked up. And so, instead of having the grand adventure, they basically rubbed two sticks together and made a fire and brought it to the elders. Mm. And now they're trying to lie to generate a cooler story of where that fire came from, like the great trials that they had to go through to get it. Mm. And first of all, the idea of linking lying and storytelling and exploring, you know, where deception ends and fiction begins is just a really cool theme to play with.
Yeah.
But I think this is just a really simple, smart, elegant game design. It has just enough it has just enough in terms of structure and mechanics to keep the game moving and to keep the game from stopping and falling apart without ever being cumbersome.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would really generate the experience. Well, first of all, it does really generate the experience of people sitting around the campfire telling the story, because that's what you do.
Yeah.
But in the game, I mean, that's how the game works.
Right.
But I really think it, I don't know if any of you ever played any campfire games or campfire storytelling games as a kid. Maybe that was just my family. But it really gets at that. And it gets at that in a cool way. And it gets at the idea of fun, like, you know, fun storytelling about, you know, hubris, about bragging, you know, I did this awesome shit. You know, Beowulf style.
Right.
Man, look at all the crazy shit I did. Like, I killed this sea serpent, and, like, man, I strangled it with my bare hand. You know, this crazy, exaggerated type of storytelling that you always seem to find in stuff that comes from an oral tradition, whether that's the Odyssey or Beowulf or whatever.
Mm.
Or, you know, the Native American folklore that they're talking here. It gets at that kind of boasting style of storytelling. And it does it, I think it does it in a really cool, seamless way. And some of the little mechanical touches are really cool. Like the ability of a character to say, and then I died. And to force the other characters to say, shit, he's standing right there. How do we fix this? You know, how did we bring him back to life? Yeah. That just seemed like such a cool touch to me. To be able to, and the tokens are cool too, to be able to have something physical that you throw into the fire to indicate that you're going to do something dramatic, and to get the ability to do something dramatic, you know, so that you can kind of ration the drama, which is something that a game like this needs, so it doesn't get two balls out too quick and just stay there until everyone gets exhausted. So I thought that was really cool. It's just, like I said, really elegant game design, I thought. Any thoughts on this? I think I'm the only one who had this on my list, so.
Yeah, I don't have much to say about this one, but I think it was definitely one of the more elegant designs in Game Chef, and this Game Chef. Because I think it was definitely easy to read and to move through. And it's a game that I think might be good for, like, entry-level role players, like people just getting into it. Like, if you get a bunch of your friends together and, like, half of them have never role-played before, like, this would be a good game to get them into it. Because everybody can brag, and everybody can tell stories and, you know, exaggerate, and that's just what humans do. So, I mean, so... Oh, no problem. No, that's...
Oh, I was just going to say, and there are a lot of those in this game, Chef.
Yeah.
There are a lot of great entry-level RPGs here.
Right.
Guilty, which I talked about, was another one. And there are a lot of real games that get at the fun social elements of assuming different characters.
Mm-hmm.
And frame it in a way that people can easily connect to. Like, oh, that reminded me of something I used to do as a kid.
Right.
Whether it's make-believe games with box houses, or whether it's playing Risk,
right.
Or if playing, playing cards, you know,
cards
and robbers, or,
yeah, really.
Or coming up with imaginary worlds. This act of taking these little bits and isolating them and connecting them to everyone's personal experience and not loading them down with a bunch of mechanics that create a real barrier to entry.
Right.
I mean, it's perfect way to get people who are at least vaguely interested in imaginative storytelling into RPGs. And I love that because that's what I try to do with my own, with some of my own games. Is what I look at when I'm trying to design mechanics. Although the subject matter of a lot of my games, a lot of your games too, Rudy, probably kind of turns some people off, maybe prohibitive in that area, in that way. But just having those mechanics that anyone can pick up, understand, and enjoy that link back to personal experience, I think it's great.
Yep.
Alex. Did you want to tell us it wasn't an RPG?
It was a great, BS in Rob, and that you were able to, tell great high tales of. It's, it is what it is.
So, I'm getting, like, a big shrug from you about this game. Is that about right?
Wait.
Okay.
I'm just messing with you. It was okay.
Number 7.
Right.
Alex, what was your number? Your number 7.
Alright, so my number 7, I'm going to keep it short just because I was so angry at seeing this game that I had to bring it up. It's Eula, the game. Just from reading this perspective by itself, I thought it was going to be the greatest, Game Chef game ever to be produced.
And Alex
says, if you look at
it, I'm going to cut it in just a second. I know you and Rudy have something to say about this game. I don't, so this is my bathroom break. I will be back.
Righto.
Go on.
You're supposed to keep it a secret.
Yeah. Believe in transparency. Okay, I'm headed out. I'm going.
Okay, so, I'll just pretend Will's here and that he agrees with everything I say, alright?
That'll work.
Okay. So anyway, Eula the Game is, it's one of the biggest, I feel like I've been hoodwinked when I saw the title of this. Because if any of you other nerds out there, or just people who pay attention, when you read a contract for, PC software, it's called the Eula, and it actually is, it's an acronym for some agreement that you make. It's like some license agreement thing. And when I saw Eula the Game, I thought it was going to be about a game where you make a contract with, one of the game ship elements, like a coyote or something like that, because coyotes are tricksters.
Mm.
So I thought it was going to be, the ultimate, you reading a series of rules and then trying to see whether or not you actually agree with them. And it's going to be like lawyers ruling to the umpteenth degree. Because, you know how much people despise rules lawyers. Whereas no, you can't do that because of, in page 57 of the, of the dungeon manual, you have to have a wand save in order to do this. It's not, you can't do dexterity save. Reflex, I mean.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And so when I actually opened up the dock, my dreams were shattered by seeing this bullshit, of North Africa and tribal. Just, it was fucked up.
Yeah, I was.
That's all I gotta say about it.
All right, well, I mean, I feel kind of the same way. I was a little disappointed that basically it wasn't a game where you're playing an EULA or something like, or where the mechanics are basically like, you know, trying to make deal or make things that fuck over other people and, you know, shut them down. That's kind of what I expected it to be. But one thing I did kind of like about this was the, I guess, the setting, which I guess you didn't really like. But
No. I was fine with it. It was the blatant, insult that the author threw at me with the title.
Oh, right, yeah. But no, I like the way this game uses, or the way this document uses language is pretty interesting. Like, let me just read a passage here. Deep in the middle of nowhere, south from absolute abandonment, west from there be dragons. You know, that kind of stuff is, like, all through the document itself, and it was fun to read.
Yeah, it was very poetic, you know.
Yeah, it was. It was lyrical, almost. But, I like the idea of, like, the corporations being, you know, kind of like Shadowrun, where the corporations are all out to fuck each other and you're caught in the middle. But yeah, that's basically all I have to say about this game.
Well, before we wrap up the discussion here and then, you know, let Will say something about it,
mm-hmm.
The authors were, is it Keel?
Yeah.
And Zakonda Sunders.
Mm-hmm.
Alright, that's all kind of. By the way, those were the authors, in case you were interested. I mean, really, it's decent. It's just the whole point was it could have been so much better if it actually was revolved around the title.
Hmm.
And yeah, I'm pretty sure Will agrees with everything we say.
Absolutely. Did I? Am I going to be arrested now?
No, you just admitted that you like to do a. No, you just admitted you like to, you know, chug huge amounts of fluids.
Yeah, that was a mistake.
Ooh.
Anyways, go ahead. Who's next?
I think I am. I believe. And actually,
yeah.
When you talk about chugging a lot of fluids, that's actually a nice segue into this game. It's called One Last Night. Let me see who the author is. I don't have it pulled up right now. The author is Abram Busser. I think I'm pronouncing that right. But basically, this is a game about alcohol and fire. And that you have, it's basically like a drinking game set in a kind of post-apocalyptic type thing where you kind of go through the, You kind of move through a post-apocalyptic narrative while drunk, off your ass, basically. And because half of
hopefully you won't be drunk off your ass until later in the game.
Right, yeah. I guess it all depends on how your tolerance is and whatnot. But the real thing I liked about this game was that it uses alcohol. And I've seen...
Fire.
And fire, yeah. Because it has candles. And it even says, this is a game with candles and alcohol. Please be careful. So, I like the idea, and I don't really drink that much, but I like the idea of, you know, everybody taking that thing where, you know, everybody's kind of BSing and, you know, we're getting drinks together and getting ready to play, taking that and turning that into part of the game. I think that's really fucking cool. Because that's the kind of stuff that, you know, that happens to a lot of groups anyway. You know, when friends get together, you want to BS and you want to talk about shit and you want to have some drinks, that kind of stuff. And this basically takes that and kind of segues it into a game, which I thought is pretty cool. Trying to think of other things I thought were cool about this. The manual was really interesting, I thought. Here are some rules from the manual. It says, until the game is finished, do not eat. That in a game with alcohol, that's just awesome. And, yeah. And until the game is finished, do not drink from the cups unless directed to do so. Yeah, I mean, I just thought, just the way it's like no bullshit. You know, yeah, this is a game. This is a drinking game. You know, please drink responsibly or whatever. But other than that, you know, it's going to be drinking and post-apocalyptic fun. And it's what it says on the tin, basically. And yeah. That's pretty much all I have to say about that.
Alex?
I don't really have much to say about it. Just good. I think, actually, you know, to be honest with you, that game was probably, number 45 as I was reading, like, you know, before going to bed.
Right.
So there are a few of them that were, like, you know, that were okay kind of games that were almost forgotten completely.
I liked this game when I was reading it, but as a dude who doesn't drink, I felt excluded from this game. I guess as long as we're being inclusive, like, it would have been cool if there were rules for dudes who don't drink. And I don't know how you could possibly change this game into a game that facilitated people who don't drink. But that would be cool.
Instead of alcohol poisoning, it could just be water poisoning.
That's true. Mm. You know, once I made a terrible, terrible mistake, and I was hanging out with some people who were playing a drinking game, and I said, I'll drink coffee.
Ooh.
And I think I got more strung out on coffee than they did on alcohol. I think I drank 8 pots of coffee then.
Holy shit.
I was not in good shape after that. I got fucked up. I don't know if it was 8 pots of coffee. It was 4 or 5 pots of coffee.
Though. Wow.
I damaged myself.
Wow.
So anyway,
right.
This game, I don't have much to say about this game. I think conceptually it's very cool. But while I was reading it, I couldn't really imagine myself playing it. So I guess I didn't really dig as deep as perhaps I normally would. So.
Yep.
My number 7.
Roger.
Unless someone else had something to say about this.
No, I'm fine.
No, okay. My number 7 continues my trend of picking games that either have titles or authors that I cannot fucking pronounce. And I really tortured myself, but I enjoyed these games so much that I was willing to go through it. Thin Day Sec? I guess. I looked up the pronunciation online. I listened to it, and I can't do it. It means end of the century, basically, or turn of the century, by James Mullen. This is Steampunk Fringe, the game, and that's how James Mullen sells it.
Mm.
And to be honest, you know, I'm not a big fan of steampunk, and I'm not a big fan of Fringe. I actually do like Fringe. I watch it now. I disliked it for the first couple of seasons and didn't watch it, and then I was told, you should go back and watch it, because the third season gets really good. And during one depressed weekend, I watched, like, all 40 episodes of the first two seasons, so I could get to the third season. And I discovered that the third season was okay. But now I have to watch it, because I've invested so much. But anyway, so my point is that this game did not sell me on concept alone. I read the first couple of pages, and luckily it was early in the list of games. Mm-hmm. It was one of the first ones before I was exhausted and before I started occasionally, I have to admit, not necessarily finishing a game that didn't seem like it was my kind of thing. But I stuck with this game. In part, I stuck with it because at first I was trying to read all of the games all the way through, but also because it had this kind of fun, jokey way that it was written in this kind of faux Victorian voice, but not really like serious business Victorian voice. So I said, okay, that's kind of cool. I'll read it. It's just fun. But what I discovered was an amazingly complete game in its tiny, tiny packets. First of all of the setting stuff is pitch perfect. It got me excited about a setting that I would not normally be excited about. But more than anything else, what this game has is an absolutely amazing, I think, dice mechanic. It has a one-roll, incredibly simple die mechanic that is almost always going to generate an interesting, dramatic outcome. You have two sets of stats, which is something that originally I said, oh, no, look, it's a game with stats and dice. But you have two sets of stats, and rolling over your number in one set of stats generates a success, but on the same roll, rolling under your number, failing to roll over your number in another stat generates a complication. So, for example, you can roll your die and succeed at what you were trying to do, but still get a dramatic complication. And have all of that generated by a single 1d6 die roll based on stats that you get to set yourself with a point by, and where the points are tied together so that you can choose when you're statting yourself to try to limit your complications at the cost of not necessarily being as successful, or to limit your successes at the cost, or excuse me, to get more successes at the cost of also getting more complications. It's that complication mechanic that I find really interesting in the way he sells it. Like, you may succeed, there may be, I'm trying to remember his example, you might find trace chemicals in a crime scene, and you're analyzing the trace chemicals, but while you're analyzing the trace chemicals, you might also end up accidentally poisoning yourself. So you might, in the same roll, generate the outcome that you figured out what the chemicals were. You analyze them, you know how they were generated, but you also just poison yourself without having to roll on multiple tables or make saving throws or make any kind of superfluous rolls. One roll that both resolves and complicates. And I thought, that was magnificent. And is also not totally arbitrary, because it's based on stats that you started at the beginning of the game. So to have a mechanic that is that simple, that does so much, and that is not 100% arbitrary, and that's so flexible, I thought was holy shit. That really impressed me. The other thing that I loved, once again, this idea of having such a complete package in so little space. He actually has a fully playable adventure in here, and still well under his
is it 3,000?
Word limit, the 3,000 word limit. And so you have a full game, a complete game, everything you need to play the game, and a module, all in 16 half pages.
Oh, wow.
And it's a good module, too. It's a really cool adventure that I'd like to play. And that really helped to sell me on the game, too. If I wasn't sure at that point, I read the adventure, which is a kind of fun little pseudoscience mystery about this lantern with, those Victorian-style slide lanterns?
Oh, right.
With slides that generate, summon, like, whatever's on the slide.
Right.
And it's played out in a cool, like, goofy mystery style that really does feel like Friends. It just seemed like such a wonderfully deceptive and complete package that I couldn't resist putting this game on the list, even though it's totally not the kind of game I'd go looking for. Either of you have anything to say about this?
No, I don't have much to say about this game.
You pretty much said everything that I wanted to mention. Like, sometimes I don't really like a dice system where it's that concrete of possibilities for failure. Just because I'm not a big fan of dice telling being led to, for me to fail easily. I'm a very positive style of player, and just the idea that you have you have to make a sacrifice between the two methods he talks about for your punishments and your successes, it doesn't make that much appealing to me. But I do agree, it is set up pretty well.
Yeah. Well, what I like about the complications, though, is that they're not really punishments. What they are an invitation for... It's basically almost a scene-framing thing, because it's like, oh, I'm poisoned. That's where this story's headed. You know, now I have to figure out how to get rid of the poison, and it keeps the plot moving, you know? Instead of just having a roll, you succeed, oh, I succeeded, keep going, or oh, I failed. Fuck. I succeeded, and I also got a little bit of bait to lead me in a new direction and to keep the plot churning. In a cinematic way, which I think is cool, it feels like a movie or a TV series, Succeeded, but, oh, this thing came out of it. There's this complication, there's this surprise.
Right. So
it keeps...
Right, other than that, that's pretty much all I wanted to say.
Okay. Rudy, nothing to say about this game?
No, I think you guys pretty much hit it.
Okay, on to our number sixes. Alex, what's your number six?
All right, so now my number six one is actually a game that is kind of decent. So it has upgraded in the quality scale. It's called A Delicate Operation. And... What?
No, I'm just glad you're going to talk about it.
Yeah, that...
Anyways, what I really liked about it was the premise was, it was okay. It made it to where there was definitely a dramatic hook into what you're doing there. Aside from the actual mechanics itself, it felt like it was almost all mechanics, and then you had to force the dialogue into it. You're kind of like how most card games are in general, because the rule system is a card game. The way it is, you get four random cards, and then you have to draw cards and such in order, and you have to get a card that's 1 point above or below the card, and you have to dance your way towards the center in order to save the king. And when all four people do it, everyone's happy and they go home a winner. And one of the people is a spy who is trying to enforce the death of the guy. And they win if the guy doesn't, if things go bad.
Right.
But yeah, the thing that I really didn't care for too much about it was, even though I like the concept of the whole assassination thing, the card mechanics themselves, it felt like it was going to get very messy very fast in terms of the layout of the board, because you're going to need a table for sure.
Oh, big table.
And,
yeah.
And you're going to be able to stand over it, too. So, some of the height challenge people are going to be at a disadvantage at this one. But because of how much it's going to stretch out for a full point of putting cards on top of each other, it can become a real mayhem real quick. And then on top of that, the other part that I kind of didn't care for was that if you can choose to not put down any cards at all, and then everyone has to discard their hand in the meanwhile. So you could just be, again, this enables the game to where you could be the king of dicks and just say, I got nothing. everyone just card your hand.
Right.
And it's like, oh, but I was about to play something next turn. And it's like, I know, because I'm secretly the spy that I just told you right now.
Yeah.
And I'm going to discard my hand every single turn. Because you really could just be the, like, you really could just do that. You can just say, yeah, I'm just going to discard my hand until everyone's done. But I guess the guy is assuming that everyone's going to play kind of fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also that you don't want to tip your hand and let everyone know that you're the spy, because you could be penalized for that in points. Because if they can guess you as a spy, they get bonus points for that.
Yeah.
Oh, right, yeah.
Go ahead, Ray.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that that game was really, it was a really interesting concept, I thought. And I don't really like card games that much, but this seems like a card game that I'd actually like to play.
Is that all you had, Rudy?
That's pretty much it.
This game, the reason why is it all is this is a game I wanted to talk about that basically got cut from my list because I decided I've got so many games here. I don't have room for... I've got so many RPGs on my list that the only way to really keep this focused is to take out things that were I guess, outside of my own definition of RPGs. To me, this is a parlor game, and it presents itself as a parlor game.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really cool parlor game, because I like the fact that not only does it have this fun little treacherous card game component, but it also has moments of dialogue, and it has this tricky word-guessing game, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it mixes together all of these different parlor games in a fun little package with a cool narrative hook to it. So I guess it is an RPG. I mean, I say everything's an RPG, right? But it has a really compelling, I think, narrative hook, the idea that there's been an assassination attempt and you're trying to save this guy, this king, but you're also trying to make alliances with the doctors from other kingdoms because you know there might be a war afterwards. There's so much tension in that idea.
Hmm.
But even stripped of all that, there's a really fun social parlor game here.
Right.
I feel like there's almost too much game here in some ways. Like, between all of the rules for the card game, plus the word-guessing game, you know, the secret word game, it feels like almost like you might be leaning kind of hard on the reference material during the game, on the manual during the game, which, for a game like this, which needs to be quick, you know, snappy from point to point to point, needs to keep flowing in order for it to be a fun parlor game. Maybe it's a little bit too complex for that. But I just think there's a lot of cool ideas in this game.
Yeah, and I forgot to mention this, but the author is Daniel Wishaw. So there you go, in case anyone was wanting to hear that.
And he also created a game called Shady Grove. Is it anyone going to talk about that?
No, it's not on my list.
Okay. I just wanted to mention that just because it's a really cool concept. It's basically a not collectible card game, but it's a card game... I guess almost Munchkin-esque in the terms of meaning that it uses unique cards, but that people don't customize their deck.
Right.
You know, anyway, it's a Munchkin-esque card game about people in a nursing home with dementia losing their minds, and the different components of their personality fighting against each other. And I just thought that was a really cool concept. Didn't have room for it on my list, but I wanted to give a shout out to that because I would totally play that game.
Yeah, something tells me we're going to have like an extra 20 honorable mentions as we progress down the list that we just forgot about. But you're like, oh yeah, I forgot about that.
This fucking game is cool. Rudy, what's your number 6?
My number 6 is actually Into the Void, which we talked about already. But I just want to say once again that Space Madness is awesome, and this is a really awesome take on that. And that's pretty much it.
My number 6 is To Travel These Pathways by Abby. What to say about this game? This game... You know how I was talking about these games the entries that are really, like, try to strip RPGs down as small as they can get? This manages to strip it down probably farther than any other game in this competition. This really is... Well, first of all, it's a role-playing poem. It doesn't introduce itself as that. And it's a lot... I assume that play is going to be longer than with most role-playing poems, because usually role-playing poems are designed to be played in about 15 minutes. This seems like a game that might take an hour or more to play. But, anyway... This is a game, basically, where you wander around in the woods with flashlights and play make-believe. That's really what this is. The pitch is that you are coyote... Is it coyote spirits, I think?
Yeah, I think there's something like that.
Some form of coyote. And you're wandering around inside the neural passages of a dying giant and re-experiencing her memories. So, in real life, you're walking around a forest with a flashlight, and you'll stop, and you'll play out a you'll turn the flashlight into the woods and play out a memory. You know, play an impromptu scene, just improvised on the spot. And then, when you're done... And you do this with one friend, I guess. Although I could imagine you doing it with more than one friend. Then, when the scene's done, you pick up your flashlight, go walking through the woods again, stop, boom. Do another, we'll play another scene, pick up your flashlight, move through the woods again. And what I think... No, there's a lot of things I think is really cool about this. Which is amazing, considering it's such a... That's it. What I told you, that's the whole game. Except there's also an epilogue, which I thought was kind of unnecessary, honestly. Where you play back some of your favorite memories when you leave the woods. You play the memories back again and sort of talk about them. And I thought, like, given how sparse and stripped down this game was... I feel like you could have done without that. You could have almost, like, exchanged a knowing glance or something at the end and had the same effect. Yeah. And I feel like, in some ways, reliving what happens in the forest afterwards kind of dilutes the emotional impact of it. But anyway, what I love about this game is, and Rudy knows this, I like to wander around, like, in the woods at night and get lost. And... That idea of turning that kind of restless wandering into a game in a way that doesn't in any way get in the way of you wandering around aimlessly in the woods. Hmm. In a way that transforms that into something or even transcends that and tries to get at the magic of that.
Right.
Or the you know, the almost mystical like quality of that, I think is pretty cool. I like, once again, how simple it is and how it doesn't try to do anything more than it has to do to accomplish the emotional effect it's going for.
Right.
But more than anything else, I have to say I love the concept. The idea of the mind as a physical landscape is something that I've been, like, I don't know, I've been grooving to for a little while now. I mean, it's just something that I thought was really cool. The idea of thinking of all those nooks and crannies inside your gray matter, you know, the physical folds of your brain as being physical passageways and valleys and someone walking through that and experiencing that, that just seems really cool. Now, I always thought of it in a very different way. I just thought of it as being, like, as a very... claustrophobic, tight space, you know, full of that neurochemical dust, so you'd always be... So I had a very different way of imagining it, but I just like that idea of turning the physical brain into a landscape. Yeah. And what better than the woods at night you know, with all the little winding paths and all the paths that are just created as you walk. I don't know. I just thought that it was a really cool, simple, effective role-playing poem or game. I mean, I guess there's no scoring component. There's no competitive component. But there's definitely, gets back to that imagination, let's pretend type of play. In a way that strips it bare, like Handle with Care does.
Yeah.
But unlike Handle with Care, it doesn't infantilize it. You know, it doesn't compartmentalize it as, or present it in a way where it's clearly a childish or childlike experience, which several games tried to do. It just says, you know, go out into the woods, have this experience, play pretend, and don't even feel self-conscious about it. Don't even feel childlike. Just do it. And I thought, yeah, that's cool. I'd do that. I'd do that right now if it wasn't cold outside. So, hey. Yeah. So,
yeah, as far as this game, I think basically the same things that you think, that it's great to have a game where you can walk around in the fucking woods with flashlights and play out stories. I mean, that's just cool. And, you know, that's basically all I have to say about this one.
Alex? Go on!
No, it was... when I saw it was a poem, and then there was actually, like, the person wasn't really explaining any rules. It was more like, if you actually read it, you might get a hint at what rules there are, if there was any. And it seemed, it was more like, you know, the isn't like the whole mental masturbation thing. It was more, it felt more like that. As in, like, this is something that you're really never going to do, but, like, we'll think about doing that, huh? Isn't that awful?
I don't know. I guess I didn't think of it that way because I wouldn't really play this game.
Yeah, see, I would actually do this, so it's free.
Yeah, Rudy and I have basically played this game already.
Yeah, it's like, if you brought me out in the woods and you wanted to try doing this, I think you would come to a point where I would, like, go tell you to go F yourself, followed by, like, me, like, just openly mocking you as we go and, like, going out in the direction of the woods, like, oh, look, remember that one time at Giant Camp, where the forest dude told me to go, to go bend over, and then everyone saw a giant, what was it, I don't want to say zit, like a boil. And they all laughed at me. Remember that one time, huh? Wasn't that terrible? Let's move on to the next area.
Well, I mean, I don't think this is a game that needs to be played totally seriously. I mean, it can be. But I don't know.
Yeah.
But I can definitely see where you're coming from.
Yeah, that's what I really felt about. I really didn't care. I saw the potential. It just felt like it was more of a game to be, like, silly about, not to, like, the poem itself felt very serious, so yeah, that's why I was like, oh shit, crap, this guy's going to be super serious about this. Or gal, since Abby.
It is, but gal, yeah.
Well, who knows? Remember that one? Okay, never mind.
I only know because after I read the game, I saw that it was just ABI, Abby, so I was like, huh. That's funny, it's not a full name, so I Googled it up and I found her blog.
I see.
Yeah, it's a hit and miss. I thought it was silly, but I saw the potential.
Okay, we're halfway through, guys.
Halfway.
Hanging in there?
Yep.
Her audience was probably like, fuck this, around 8.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Okay, number 5, Alex.
It was Young Curse at the Cafe. I said my piece already, so let's just move on to the next thing.
Okay, Rudy.
Okay, my number five was Liminal.
Oh, okay.
This is a game that's awesome because it abducts migrant workers. At least I think that's it's supposed to be. But
yeah,
I love the premise of it because it's kind of like one of those deals where, kind of like District 9, where you have like aliens as a metaphor for something, but it's not goofy. It's not, like the alienation, a migrant worker or a person coming into this country illegally might feel expressed as, some doppelganger alien that goes around and takes people. But I also thought the mechanics were pretty cool. Isn't part of it like kept secret from the the other players, the mimic player? It's kept secret, and the other three players are kind of talking, or however many players are talking, about basically discussing what they're going to do without that person there.
Well, what it is there are two character sheets: the mimic, the alien or
the alien thing,
has their own character sheet with their traits and stuff on it. And then they leave the room, and everyone else makes up a character sheet that represents the person whose life the mimic has stepped into.
Right.
So, like, details about their life that they're later going to use to catch the mimic when they act suspiciously.
Right. I like the fact that basically you can at any time say, that's not what my life is like, or that's not what... like you say, catch the mimic, basically.
Yeah, Sally wouldn't act that way.
Why are you doing that? Yeah, because that just reinforces the theme of, like, alienation and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's like, well, wow. One thing I didn't really dig was the dice mechanics for it, which I didn't... I didn't really understand why they were necessary so much.
Mm.
I guess they're kind of reminiscent of Apocalypse World, where you roll and depending on what you roll, you get different levels of control or whatever over events. But I don't know. I guess I just didn't really understand why it was really necessary to have the rolling at all. The way I would think of playing this game is basically like a Jeep form type game where, you have some people, like almost stream of consciousness type. And that's just a personal thing, but that was just one thing I didn't really care for. But
I went back and forth on the mechanics of this game. And this game's on my list, too. I'll talk about it now, but it's actually much higher on my list. At first, I had the same response. I was like, there's these traits, and you roll dice, and this is REM. Like you said, I've seen this mechanic before. What I think is really cool about the mechanics, though, is the way that he uses the dice mechanics to really magnify that borderline, to bring the borderline into really stark contrast.
Right.
Because on one side of the border, when you're passing as a migrant worker, you have these dice mechanics that are rather conventional dice mechanics, and that limit your ability, basically, to have agency in the game. Your agency is limited to how well you can pass, and it's limited to this very conventional structure. But once you pass over the border and become yourself, once you go back to your world, the mechanics totally change. And the mechanics give you 100% agency. You get to use them whenever you want. And you get the power, just like that.
Yeah.
And I think that really ties back into the theme of the game. So while I did not dig them initially, they really grew on me. And I like the idea of transformative mechanics. When you have a game that's really about two worlds, and you have mechanics that function two different ways in two different worlds, I think that's hot shit. Yes. This game, more than any other game in this contest, grew on me the more I thought about it.
Mm.
I really dug the concept, too. I loved the concept, for the same reasons you did. More than District 9, I thought this felt like a really good episode of either The Twilight Zone or The X-Files, because it has all those elements there, right? It has the cool Monster of the Week element, you know, the sci-fi element that gets you in and gets you interested. And then it uses that to deal with both, you know, socio-political issues and, like, philosophical issues, you know? Mm. It deals with immigration and migrant workers and you know, all these issues that exist at the physical border.
Mm.
So those are the social political stuff. And then it also deals with, like, philosophical questions about identity and like you said, alienation and all of that. And it does it all in a way that never seems pretentious, never seems like it's shoving it down your throat.
Right.
But it's there. It's there. It's implicit in the mechanics, and it's implicit in the way the game functions. And that's what a really good episode of The X-Files has felt like to me, or a really good episode of The Twilight Zone. Yeah. Like, you're getting all of that substance, but you're also getting a really digestible, tasty package, too.
Yeah.
Like you said, I loved the character creation, where the guy leaves the room and they create the guy that he or she is trying to pass as.
Yeah, the real person that they're...
Right. Who's gone. Who has never played.
Who never shows up. Yeah.
And I don't know. This game gets me really excited. I would like to play this game. And it gets me more excited the more I think about it. Mm. It's a really, really cool game. I don't know what else to say. Except that this is a really cool game that has the kind of things I look for in games.
Yeah, basically I was hooked at the premise.
Yeah.
That was what really got me, so...
But I like the ways the mechanics interact with the premise. I do think there could be something a little more original than before they revert to their alien form and cross the border.
Mm.
For the mimic resolution mechanics were a little bit been there, done that. Mm. And I think maybe they could come up with something a little bit more creative for that. But beyond that, I really liked it. And I definitely like the way that the mechanics turn, especially since there's that hidden agency component there that you almost miss if you don't really look at it. The idea that your power over your character totally changes depending on what side of the border you're on.
Oh yeah, see that's true, and that's something else that I thought was pretty interesting. The way you've got that dichotomy between the two character types,
and the ability for this to really turn into two different games.
Yeah.
That freedom there. Because you could go through this whole game on one side of the border as the mimic, trying to pass, trying to keep your life up, your fake life up.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could break down and run across the border and go crazy and have the whole second half of the game devoted to you really flexing your muscles and throwing your weight around on the other side of the border and doing badass things. And he even suggests that you could sort of start a revolution and bring the fight to the other side of the border.
Yeah.
You know, there's all this cool shit in this game. So much possibility. I would really like Big Chiefs. This is another game would really like to see fleshed out into a bigger package with lots more details and possibilities and bits and pieces. Not necessarily new mechanical bits and pieces. I think it's a complete game mechanically. But, you know, more
options. Like
more flavor. Yeah, more flavor, more options, more whatever.
Yeah. Yep.
Alex, Liminal.
Yeah, when I'm sorry, I'm just thinking, because I saw the name of the author, and I just wanted to straight-face this as much as I could, but I just couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to say that it's amazing that this guy posted a game that was made by a dude 700 years ago.
Robert Bruce?
Or Bruce?
Yeah.
Oh, Wikipedia.
The King of Scotland? The King of Scotland.
Oh! Oh, right.
Oh, Robert the Bruce! Popular, modern... Huh! Never heard of him before.
Yeah, it was... I heard about him, like, because I played a card game that had him as a main hero that you could pick, and I was like, oh, this is going to be so great if I could do it, but, like, no, I can't play a straight face. everything that you guys said was pretty much spot on. There were some things I did like about it, but overall, it felt, you know, it felt like it was one of those games that was just too goofy for me to, like, even want to play.
Mm. Too what for you to want to play? I missed the word.
Too goofy.
Oh, too goofy. Really? You thought this was
a game? Well, it's a fish out of water story.
Right.
Hmm. That's what I mean. So I don't think there was a lot of seriousness that you could really play with this, or it felt like it was very light and, you know, like a romp kind of game.
Hmm. Huh. I had kind of the opposite interpretation. It's interesting how you can.
Well, I mean, you must understand. Well, I am the elitist prick for this conversation.
That's right.
You are. The everything's an RPG guy. You're the super.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, man.
So of course we're going to have opposite views about this.
Man, I don't understand, man. This is such a dark game. I'll stop. So what was that? That was five.
That was five.
Alex, you did your five, right? I'm lost again. Okay, so it must be my number.
Five.
Yep. Okay. My number five is On Coyote's Visit to Earth by Ezio Malega. Close enough. This game was really cool. This is another game that, because Google butchered it.
Oh, yeah.
I got enough of it to know that I really liked it. This is basically, it's another Trickster God Coyote game, and there were a ton of those, but this is a nice twist on it, I think. Basically, the hook of the game is Coyote happens upon the spirit of a dead man, and they end up making a bet, and the dead man's basically like, you know what? You think you're hot shit because you're a god, but if you had to deal with the shit that I've been through as a human, like the drudgery of day-to-day life, you couldn't take it, bro. You could not handle that shit. And Coyote's like, nah, man, nah, I could totally handle that shit. You have no idea. So anyway, what ends up happening is Coyote goes to Earth, enters the body of this dead man and possesses it. And the whole game plays out as a contrast between, like, the bleak realities of life played by, and each of the different facets of this bleak reality is played by a different player.
Hmm.
And Coyote fighting inside the body of this dead man for control. You know, Coyote is trying to make his life magical, but he doesn't have the ability to really use his magic anymore. So he's trying to get at the whimsy and the fantasy and the enjoyment in life that he felt as a god.
Hmm.
Whereas these facets of mundane life are fighting for control of his psyche, basically, to keep him down and to keep him focused on the day-to-day menial shit. And it plays out with a really simple, kind of intuitive dice mechanic that I thought maybe could be fleshed out a little more. But I really like the pitch of this game. I like the fact that at the beginning of the game, you decide what the principles of reality are. And these are really the kind of, like, fundamental mundane truths of the reality, and Coyote has to operate within those principles while he's battling off the different aspects of his psyche, and still try to cling to this positive, magical view of life. And one thing that I thought maybe wouldn't work, but I liked anyway, is that the endgame mechanic is based on surrender. Basically, you keep playing until one group, either Coyote or the... I wish I could remember the term he used, but the facets of mundane life. Either Coyote or the mundane gets fatigued and gives up.
Right.
So the players have to get fatigued and give up. And I thought that was so fitting for what the game's about, you know? That this is a game that's really about mundane life trying to wear you down, trying to strip the magic out of you, and you trying to be resilient and hold on. And the game doesn't even try to come up with some kind of cute mechanic for handling it. It's whoever can hold on the longest wins.
Yeah.
And I thought, that is something that a lot of games wouldn't be daring enough to do. I think they would try to come up with a cute die mechanic for the end game, instead of actually having it be based on psychological fatigue. Mm. Now, there is a die mechanic for resolving conflicts between Coyote and the mundane, which is what I'm calling it because I keep forgetting the term. But and that mechanic I think works adequately. It's basically a roll-off mechanic based on how many of the different facets of the mundane can insert themselves into the scene, and whether or not Coyote's trying to violate the principles that you established at the beginning of the game. And if Coyote succeeds, he gets to act in a whimsical way. And if the mundane succeeds, then Coyote is ground down and he has to, go back to the drudgery of life. There's a cool thing, though, within these die mechanics, where if Coyote gets double, he smiles, which means that he gets a momentary burst of his magic back, and something small and magical is introduced into real life. And I thought, that's a cool way to ration that out.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just really enjoyed the concept and execution of this game.
Right. I don't have much to say about it because
you couldn't read it.
I couldn't read it with Google Docs, so or Google Translate. Yeah.
And Alex, you didn't read it because. Confusion there. So, I guess, okay, so moving on to number four. Alex.
Alright. My fourth one was Beyond Coyote's Door, and this was by Chris Henderson. The thing that I really liked about this one was it was a trait-based game, and I know, Will, how much you've been, you were poo-pooing trait games.
Yeah, I kind of...
But anyways, what it was, you were just a normal person, and the concept was you go through the Coyote's door, the trickster's door. Okay, sorry, I got something in my throat here. But what ended up happening is you go through the door and you think it's heaven, you think it's the afterlife, the good place. And what happens is you are met by different spirits of the Native American, folklore, the bull and all that kind of stuff. Well, the buffalo, I mean.
Yeah, I remember the part about the bull.
Right.
And then each person plays out a scene where they have a conversation with them, and based on, it's kind of a social party mechanic because everyone votes to see which one was good, which one wasn't good. Which one they liked the least out of all the four conversations. Mm-hmm. And you go through each section talking about the different talking with the different spirit animals. And what I really liked about it was it allowed for a lot of creativity. because, you know, you could pretend to be, like, you know, the snake, you could pretend to be, you know, all these other different animals, and, like, you have your own personal take on how they would be, and everyone gets to see how they would respond to that kind of conversation. And I really do like the whole point that they think they're going into heaven right away, but really they're being challenged by each of the spirit animals to see if you are worthy to go to through the final door.
Hmm.
Yeah, yeah, it uses a trait-based system where... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, no, go ahead. Finish up.
Yeah, and it... Oh, I really liked this trait-based system because what it did is it helped you highlight, you know, your previous history of your character, and you could use that as ways to introduce conversation pieces, which each of the spirit animals kind of like flashback histories or just like professions in general, and that could help the other players you know, challenge you like based on what your previous profession was, and they can go like, oh, you used to be a sailor back in the day. Well, I'm gonna really pull a good one on you and like have a discussion about you being like a terrible sailor who like gut like sea turtles and crap like that, and you know, all that good stuff to kind of like, you know, like mess with each other. It's like the ultimate. It's like a great prankster game, and that's what I really liked about it.
Yeah, one thing I really like you said, was the aspect of trickery, or, you know, trickster. Because
deceit,
yeah. I mean, because the coyote, you know, in Native American folklore is a trickster. And I think this was one game that really got at that. And, I also...
Yeah, but I feel like that was almost a little too meta for my taste.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see what you mean, sort of, but...
Oh, no, there was a lot of games in this list where they used the literal coyote as the trickster instead of, like, you know, making it to where it was, like, you know, like last game where it was a literal coyote, a guy who steals people, you know,
right,
helps get immigrants into America. This was more of the literal interpretation of a
right.
coyote in terms of, like, the spiritual sense, or instead of the animal or the handler, the, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool.
I'll be honest, this is a game that I skimmed because it looked so much like all the other games. It was just a big clump of games that were like coyote trickster games. And some of them were really impressive, I have to admit, because some of them made it on my list.
Yeah.
Not that that's the end-all, be-all for being an impressive game, but this one seemed in some ways so much like almost the conglomeration of the others. You know, it felt kind of like the other games put in a bowl and mixed up. It seemed very similar, so I guess maybe I didn't pay it as much attention as I should have.
I feel really unfortunate about that, because I really did like it, but, I mean, other than that, what else is there to say? You know, I give it, you know, two thumbs up in a way, but yeah, that's my take for number four. All right, Rudy, how about, let's start with yours.
All right, my number four was...
Yeah, let's continue with yours.
All right. My number four was Keepers of the Lantern.
Yes.
Which is basically a kind of werewolf game with stress positions used as a mechanic. And I thought that was really... that's just really cool. I mean, basically you're portraying these, like, priests of some kind of religious order, and I think it's like the Order of the Lantern or something like that, and they're trying to protect the world from coyote, and like you're the whole game you're trying to figure out, you know, who works for coyote and who's because if coyote people get the lantern, then the game is over and they win. And I think the idea of having a real stress position used in the mechanics just makes the competitive nature of the game even more awesome. Because also while you're holding the lantern, the other players are supposed to be, or the other characters are like kind of bickering and gossiping about you, and you can't do anything but just hold the lantern. Because out of respect for the lantern, you have to hold it out like, straight from your body. So it's a literal stress position. And I think that's just really cool, the way the way that's used in play.
I like the fact that this is probably the first game I've ever seen that goes out of its way to make you physically uncomfortable.
Right, yeah.
Like, there are games where emotional discomfort is a core part of the game. But this is the first time I've ever seen a game where physical discomfort was a core part of the mechanics, and I really dug that. I was less enthralled by the flavor and the background and stuff. I feel like a lot of that was undercooked. Mm. And in some ways, the game seemed like it was kind of rushed out the door. But that core mechanic of being both physically and emotionally uncomfortable,
right,
because you're trying to hold this lantern, and he says the lantern, whatever you use for the lantern, it must weigh at least 5 pounds.
Yeah, so it has to be heavy.
Trying to hold this heavy object at arm's length while people are gossiping about you.
Right.
It's putting you in the most uncomfortable position possible, and the timer is ticking down, and you know, if you hold on to the lantern, your team is definitely going to win the game.
Right. So there's a lot of pressure there.
As soon as you pass it off, you might be passing it to Coyote and handing him the game.
Right.
So it's like, how much of this shit am I going to put up with?
Yeah.
You know, in order to win.
Yeah, no.
I thought it was a really cool basic game design.
Yeah. It's by Seth Ben Ezra, by the way. Yep. So what about your number 4?
Oh, Alex, do you have anything to say about Keepers of the Lantern?
Oh, yeah.
No, you guys were spot on with what I was thinking about. I did like the physical thing the most, since, yeah, there's almost very little. There's very little games that actually are in making you involved physically. It's usually a mental thing, and I like the mix-up.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, my number 4 is the Entropy game by Lord Papyrus 420.
Yeah.
Alex, this is on your list too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's getting there.
Okay. So, what I liked about this game... Well, let me just... And I hope I'm not drastically misinterpreting the game here, but let me just clear the air and say that it seems clear to me that this game is designed to be a pretty savage satire of the culture of the Forge.
Mm.
It never says that it's about the Forge, but yeah, I'll leave it at that. But I think it succeeds at that. What I really love about this game is that it's a satirical game in every way that Big Chiefs wasn't a satirical game.
Mm.
At no point does it say what it's satirizing.
Right.
It never introduces the subject that it's satirizing. It never offers direct commentary about it. In fact, it has no text that isn't rules text,
right,
if I'm correct. Or if it doesn't, or it has only very brief introductory text. The text is a system for playing the game.
Right.
And those mechanics are what satirize. It's purely through the mechanics of the game that it arrives at its satire.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, if you're going to satirize the Forge, that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Through game mechanics.
Purely through game mechanics. And if you're going to go after the social environment of the Forge, do it in such a totally asocial way.
Hmm.
That's so fitting. I just thought, this is the first time I've seen a satirical game where the satire exists purely within the mechanics, which I think is a step we need to take if we're going to create satirical games. If RPGs are going to function as satire, someone needs to create the satire that uses only the basic core parts, only the gamey parts of the game in order to produce it.
Right.
As opposed to leaning very heavily on, you know, what the author says at the beginning, the introduction, or the atmospheric content, or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
So I thought that was really cool. I think that in a lot of ways, especially once you get to Rule 6 and the planking thing enters, that is just such a terrific, such a terrific tearing down of some pretenses, I guess. It's just such a hilariously brutal attack on that kind of social structure. You know, this idea that it's a social structure that is superficially not about force, superficially not about rank pulling.
Right.
But in so many ways is about force, implied force, and is about rank pulling.
Right.
And that the planking mechanic, just where you voluntarily plank, and whoever remains flat on the ground, immobile for the longest, is the victor.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's not just the forge. I mean, so many message forges. It's like whoever holds out the longest,
right,
wins.
Right.
Or whoever shows deference for the longest wins.
Right.
Even if it's humiliating. I don't know. I thought that was fantastic. I can't speak to whether or not this game would be much fun to play. But, I mean, I guess, I don't know, Alex, do you think this would be a fun game to play? I mean, you must, because you put it on your list.
Yeah, the first thing that attracted to me is the, you know, the what the fuck, you know, kind of like, you know, what the hell's going on with this game? And then secondly, like, after I read it a second time and I understood what was going on, this would be perfect to pick a ridiculous... This is basically like the ultimate satire game, because you can just